suggested, why don't you, send a cable to the, to Secretary Muskie, indicating this and asking, was there, is there, any such desire on the part of the incoming administration? So
I've missed something. How did you learn of the Holbrooke, the alleged Holbrooke Allen conversation?
It was a telephone call by some individual to Stabe Roy.
Oh, I see.
Asking not to be identified, but to pass it along to me for my information.
On the open lines.
Or it was to, at his home, sure. Well, there are no closed lines. And so I sent a cable to the, to Secretary Muskie, and said there had been some indication, et cetera, et cetera. And, okay. Quoting the fact that I had put sent my resignation to the president-elect, and that as far as I was concerned, I was willing to cooperate in any way. I then get a reply back, and I'm quoting this exactly. We have checked with the transition team, who have stated there is no wish for your early departure from post. They would like you to arrange to return at your own convenience and have asked us to express their appreciation for your service in Peking. That was on the 7th of January. I had just before that, I think, Secretary Haig, Mr. Haig had finally been designated. I had sent him a letter in which I had stated to the effect that I, of course, would cooperate in any way, including, if need be, an early departure from post. And I quoted this in my telegram to Secretary Muskie. That's why the reference to there is no wish for your early departure from post. Then on the day after the inaugural, on the 21st of January, John Holdridge had been nominated as Assistant Secretary for East Asia. And he sent me this cable, which said, as I look forward to assuming the position of Assistant Secretary for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, I want to express my admiration of your superb performance as the first American ambassador to the People's Republic of China. Your role has been critical to the achievement of the remarkable advances in the relationship in recent years. I am aware that you were informed by the transition team that you might depart Beijing at your convenience after the inaugural. I hope that you will not, however, make any definite plans for immediate or early departure. This is a sensitive period in our relations with China. I hope to have the benefit of your counsel and assistance with your successor until your successor has been named and the timing of his arrival has become clearer. The selection and confirmation of your successor may take some time. I hope, however, that any gap between your departure and the arrival of your successor can be kept to an absolute minimum without serious inconvenience to you or Sharon. Warm regards.
Now, what was the date of that?
That was the 21st of...
One day after the inauguration?
The day after the inaugural, right.
Huh, that's fascinating.
And it came by back channel, limited channel. I send a response by the same channel. Congratulations on your appointment. Your first-hand knowledge of this part of the world, including China, will work strongly in favor of our country's growing role in East Asia and the Pacific. Thank you for your generous message. I agree that any long gap between ambassadors at this post would be detrimental to our interests. We are prepared to stay, and I assume the search for my successor will proceed with due dispatch. That was on the 22nd. another phone call to State Roy from the same person, saying that my reply, although it had come through the same channel, gets exposure on the 7th floor and in the White House, and had raised Holy Cain, and John Holdrege was really under the gun, and was there something Leonard could do to try and get him off?
Good Lord.
Get him off the hot seat. So on,
and
the,
you don't know who's making these phone calls. It has to be Chaz.
That's not a bad guess. So the next day, the 23rd of January, I sent another telegram to John Holdrege. As you know, on January 7, I was notified in response to my inquiry that the transition team stated there is no wish for our early departure from post, and they would like us to arrange to return at our own convenience. So my telegram of the 23rd went on. Acting on that, we had begun preparations to return at the end of the second week following the Spring Festival about February 20. After this long a stay, I have many farewell calls to make on Chinese officials. The Premier and Foreign Minister are going to Thailand and Burma and will not return until just before the Spring Festival. This would have made some farewell calls begin February 9. In my message to you, January 22, I stated we are prepared to stay on to avoid a long gap between ambassadors at this post. I still feel that way and would hope the administration would make an early choice to put its own man in here. After further discussion and reflection, we would like to revert to the plans we had already made and to depart post on or about February 20. Hopefully some progress should have been made in selecting my successor by that time. And I presume we should go to Washington, etc., and asking for travel orders for on or about February the 20th, Beijing to Tokyo to San Francisco to Washington and then to Detroit. That was the 23rd. Then, on the 26th, I get a telegram from the secretary through Charles W. Freeman, Jr., who, of course, was in charge of the China desk. Telegram number 1833. Upon review, we have concluded that it would be best were you to leave Beijing immediately. You should seek a farewell call on the highest-ranking available foreign ministry official to inform the Chinese government that your resignation has been accepted and you are being recalled. In doing so, you should stress that your early departure has no implications for U.S.-China relations, that you have been informed that it is the intention of the United States to appoint a successor to you as ambassador at the earliest possible time. On the same date, but a few hours later, telegram number 26 hour 76. Disregard Reftel, which was sent in error. Upon review, we believe that you should plan to leave no later than February 13th. You are requested to arrange your farewell calls accordingly. In doing so, you may state you have been informed that it is the intention of the U.S. to request agreement for a successor to you as ambassador at the earliest possible time. It was Sharon's inclination that we should still stick to our date of the 20th, and I said, we're not going to fuss about a week, so we made our plans to leave on the 13th, but it was really an incredible and pretty shabby performance.
Did you ever find out from Chaz and others exactly what had transpired on the Washington end?
Chaz told Stape to tell me that what had happened had been the secretary had marked the wrong box. So he dutifully told me that. And I think not immediately, but a few days afterwards, I said, you know, I of course don't believe that
sure.
story. My guess is that it was deliberately sent, and then somebody must have said, look, you're asking for unnecessary bad publicity over nothing. What difference does it make whether it's now or two, 3 weeks from now? But what had happened on when my return cable to John Holdridge's first one, saying yes, we'd stay, because that got wider distribution than his had gotten. It got into the White House, and as I understood it subsequently, that the Bushes, particularly Mrs. Bush, was very unhappy, obviously because of my press conference of August 26th. And they were the ones who were insisting that that there not be any prolongation of the term.
Well, that's somewhat related to the Jim Lilly issue that I had mentioned to you earlier, namely that Jim Lilly thought that your blast during the campaign had been orchestrated from the White House and that it was politically motivated. Lilly being close to Bush would suggest his involvement too. I'm surprised that a cable that was supposed to be back-channeled to Holdridge would receive wider distribution.
I was you'd think that the incoming and the outgoing would get the same distributions, but I'm told that the incoming routinely get it somewhat. They get to the seventh floor, and anything that gets to the seventh floor also goes to the White House.
Well, you know, one of the things that's come out of these conversations here, but earlier, is that I'm certainly glad we handled the normalization negotiations through the White House channel communications, because I'm convinced that had we used the state channel, that it somehow one of those cables would have gone astray. I think the state security system on cables that are incoming leaves something to be desired.
Well, I think I agree with that completely, but I think further that the negotiations for normalization have been handled in an open, that is open within the system through state,
it would never
have happened.
That's
it
right.
would have dragged out so that it would have run into the politics and been indefinitely delayed.
Absolutely. That's a fascinating story that you tell.
Then on the, I already on the 27th of January, before the last of these is dated the 26th. So on the 27th of January, knowing now definitely that I'm leaving on the 13th, and the Spring Festival came on a close to a weekend, so that instead of being 3 days out, there were 4 days out. I had a session with Hans Schuh, in which I previously informally told Hans Schuh and Ji Zhaoju, those who I would like to see, and there were nine, and they had told me that this created problems for them because not that they wanted me to see all of those that I had listed, but that ambassadors are always leaving Peking at the end of their tours because in many cases the tours are not that long and there are so many of them. So we agreed that there'd only be publicity to the foreign minister and Deng Xiaoping, because that, the normalization thing made that different. But the rest would not be publicized so that they wouldn't create bad precedents for themselves, which was fine. So on the 27th of January, knowing my definite date, I went down to see Honshu to submit my list formally and to indicate the order in which I would like to see them. I wonder, I had a little trouble. I looked at the wrong year. That was done on the 23rd. I did that after I had sent my letter, my telegram, getting the word that John Holdrege was on the spot because of his kind words and asking me to stay, to say that I'd leave on February the 20th, so that I went down the 23rd to see Honshu to say I was going to leave by the 20th and like to see these people. Then, of course, a few days after that, my departure date has suddenly become February 13th. I made no bones about with Honshu and Chi Jiaoju saying what had happened, not formally or any other way, but I wasn't going to invent some reason as to why I'd suddenly moved up my departure for a week. I had my first farewell call. I'd asked to see Zhou Peiyuan, who was still president of at Beida, because he had in the early days when I was first there, he was one of the first Chinese to come frequently to the residence, and had always had a positive attitude, and of course had been heavily involved in the early educational exchanges, right, and the negotiations for that. And of course, Mondale had that historic speech out at Peking University. So I went out to Beida to pay a farewell call on him. And the next day to Wang Jun, who was still the Minister of Culture, out at his ministry. And he, of course, having been, 7 years in this country as China's representative, I think it was seven, close to it anyway. No, six.
Four.
Was it four?
70, early 70s.
Oh, you're right. 73 to 77. You're right. 4 years. It was Honshu who was here.
That's right.
Here 6 years. And both of those were very pleasant. And then on the next day, the 30th, a farewell call on Vice Foreign Minister Zhang Wenjian.
Any of these people talk about the Taiwan issue in your rounds, or was this were these calls essentially complimentary and not policy related?
Those up to this point were not policy related. Mm-hmm. And with Zhang Wenjian, we were seeing each other repeatedly anyway, and this was sort of for the record, the official
right,
farewell call. And then came the that was weekend before the Spring Festival. On February the 2nd, which was the Monday, I then paid a farewell call on Vice Premier Gong Biao, because of course I had been with him on the military delegation visit in 1980, and he and I got along pretty well. That was nothing of any particular note discussed in that one. Then on the next day, February the 3rd, this is still before the Spring Festival, went to the Great Hall for the farewell call on Deng Xiaoping. I met with him and took State Roy with me. We had a very pleasant discussion. He talked about the economy. I told him about the trip I had made a couple of months before. I commented that it was my impression, obviously I didn't know, but it was my impression that the reforms were doing quite well with regard to agriculture, and that even though there were some difficulties in industry, the necessity for retrenchment that to a country in China's stage of development, it was more important that agriculture go well at this stage than it was that industry go well. Better, both did, but that was his feeling. It was in that connection, was talking about industry, that he made the comment that based upon things that were reported to me, it sometimes seemed that you knew more about what was happening to us than we knew about ourselves. I think this goes back to the period in 78 in particular, when when American businessmen would come in and discuss things with me, I would say that what was being planned was just out of reach, it wasn't going to happen, and not being entirely negative, saying that there were other ways in which business could be cultivated. And I would think the Chinese knew this, and that it had been so reported to him. So we had a very warm and friendly discussion. I asked him about the follow-up on now that the trial of the Gang of Four was out of the way. What about their followers in the provinces? And he said, oh, we will go very slowly on that. There will not be many. Indicating that there was not going to be any great shakeup. Of course, there was even less than he was, in fact, than he was then indicating.
Or hoping for, probably.
Possibly. I'm sure that even then they were engaged in the negotiations that he was stating then what he expected to happen, which in fact didn't happen. And then we had a lunch.
Did Sharon join you?
Yes.
Did his wife join?
No. He explained that. She was not feeling well at the time, as I remember him saying so. But Wang Jian joined us at the luncheon. Zhang Wenjin, Han Xu, Zhang Wenjin's wife, and Sharon, and Sandy Roy. We had our meeting in the Fujian room, and they simply carried the table in. Fully laden into the same room, so that we then went to sit at the table. And that was a discussion of substance. And that afternoon, paid my farewell call on Vice Premier Fang Yi, put him on the list for obvious reasons. He was with Deng in the United States, had met many American delegations, having to do with science or technology. And most of that conversation was, where had I been in China? Oh, you have haven't been here. You haven't been there. Oh, you must come back. And then particularly the caves. What are the caves on the old Silk Road route?
In Turfan? Out near Turfan.
Yes, in Xinjiang. He said, you must see those. And two of the sacred mountains that... he said, you haven't seen China. You haven't seen them. Then that night at the residence, on the night of the February the 3rd, we had a dinner at the residence, our farewell dinner for Vice Foreign Minister Jiang Wenjin, and all the staff from the Americas section of the Foreign Ministry, and the leading members of the embassy. There were 21 of us all together. The next morning, the 4th of February, I went to the Great Hall to see Vice Chairman Li Xianyan. I put him on the list. We had many meetings with him, with American groups, but he had first received me when I went to China and had been very warm and gracious, made me feel very much at ease. And I told him, this is why I asked to see you. Told him about the impression that he had made upon me at that first meeting then almost 4 years before. Nothing of great substance, but a very warm meeting. That afternoon on Boi Bo, because I had been with him in the United States, nothing new, again, very, very warm and pleasant. Then the Spring Festival started on Thursday the 5th and ran through the Sunday, that Thursday, Friday, so yeah, the 4 days. And then on February the 10th, in the afternoon, my farewell call on Premier Jia Xiang. And this was in the Purple Light Pavilion in Zhangnanhai.
Zhangnanhai. Why Jia Xiang? You just put him down to meet him.
Well, I had met with him once when he was in May of 1980, after he'd been designated as the he had been named as the designated vice premier. Or was it the responsible vice premier? Anyway, he had some special title. And I had asked, I was coming back to the United States, and I had asked if I could see him at that time, and we put all of this on the record. I'd had a very good discussion with him.
Right.
Which he went into the whole question of the economy and the reforms
on. Right, I remember that.
And it was in the course of that meeting, right. I remember he had said to me, I'm saying things to you I haven't even said to my own people. Are you going to tell this to the American press? So that, of course, I'd never been in Zhangnanhai, so I was delighted. Explained what the pavilion was all about and why it was named the Purple Light Pavilion, and talked about this, that, and the other thing about the architecture, and then talked about how he saw the development of the economy. It's going to take time, but they were going to build as solid a base as they could to move forward for the future. It would be difficult, but they would make more speed this way than trying to make haste. And that he'd come back from Thailand just before the Spring Festival. And then made my farewell call on the foreign minister, also by this time, of course, the vice premier, Wang Hua. And
where was that call?
That was at the Great Hall.
At the Great Hall.
Right. And then that was followed by a dinner, which he hosted for us. It included also the senior staff from the embassy and their spouses. It was in that was very relaxed, and he was at his most charming, on his most charming behavior. I remember, of course, I was sitting on his right at the dinner table, and he gave me the ritual invitation to come back to China with, of course, with your spouse, and I took my hand, and his right hand was resting on the table. I put my left hand on top of his right hand and patted it and said, "Well, the vice chairman invited me to come to China and bring all of my family. Are you countermanding that order?" And he just laughed and said, "We are always welcome." But the fact, you know, that we could have that easy an exchange, I think, was indicative of the relationship that we had had. Then in those concluding days, many other things were going on.
Chris, let me just stop at this point and just say I would suspect that no departing ambassador has been accorded such a distinguished set of farewells as you were, and it really is a tribute to the esteem the Chinese have for you. I was just, as I was listening to you reflect on the people who wish to bid you farewell, I was thinking, you know, I think a lot of it was not because of what you accomplished, but really, or what transpired in Sino-American relations, as much as that Chinese judgment that you're a man of integrity, and that they know they could count on your word.
I'd like to think that that's so. And I think, too, that there was a feeling on their part that, in fact, I as a person reacted to them as persons and all of the Chinese as in truth equals.
That's right.
That that's the way I felt, and I think
they manifested respect for them. And empathy. You were not ready to make snap judgments about their system, which I think is important.
Well, you look around the world, there's not many systems that are working very well anymore.
So I was just brief.
There were many other things going on in these concluding days of our stay. Bill Webb, Colonel William Webb of the Air Force, who had come to China as part of the first military delegation in the embassy, and then had become chief of the military attaché, was promoted to brigadier general during this time. And I was glad it happened while I was still there, because Sharon and I were able to host a reception to honor his promotion, and to have the Chinese military come too to participate in the event.
These were then real wistful days for you.
Oh yes. Saturday the 7th of February, Sharon and I went over to the Roy's apartment, just the Roy family, to have a farewell dinner with the three boys. It was that was a very, very wonderful event. And the next day, on the Sunday, we went to the restaurant to have a Chinese, to have a Mongolian hot pot dinner with all the senior staff and their spouses. Walt Lenihan, I remember, was the master of ceremonies. And they'd had a whole bunch of limericks made up with the last line missing. And everyone got a limerick to which that person had to attach the last line. It was really quite a lighthearted and hilarious evening. I had tried to restrict the farewell luncheons and dinners in the diplomatic community to a minimum. And of course, the fact that I had to leave at such short notice gave me a good excuse, but nevertheless, there were some I had to accept. One was the Finnish ambassador and his wife, because he'd been there as long as I had been, and he very, in political terms, very conservative, but maybe because of that, very, very partial to America and America.
They have such a beautiful embassy, too.
Yes.
One of the nicest in that new section. I biked last summer up and down.
No, they're
street.
In the old section.
But isn't it Finnish architecture? And I may have
they're in an old embassy. It's a very attractive old building. It's right across from the British Embassy.
Thinking of another one.
And the other luncheon.
I'm thinking of the Swiss Embassy.
Oh, yes, the Swiss have got a beautiful place.
In the new section.
Right, and the Norwegians and the Swedes have lovely embassies, too. They're all in the new section.
That's right, but I'm pretty sure it's the Swiss.
Then the next day, a farewell luncheon hosted by the Pakistani ambassador and Mrs. Yunus at their embassy, because he had been very, very good to me during all of his stay. Codell Alexander came during these closing days. That was probably his fifth visit to China. And then on the 12th of February, I was asked if I would receive a Chinese artist, Wang Sun Ren, at the residence, and I naturally said, why? Well, he wants to see you. And so I did. And this old man came in. He was, as it turned out, 87 years of age. And he has with him a picture that he has painted that he wanted me to see. But I'm not supposed to see it because the staff had commissioned him to paint this picture for me. And it's to be given to me as a surprise. But he very much wanted to show it to me himself.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, they had picked him, one of the oldest of the Chinese artists, 87 years old, and frail physically, but mind absolutely good, and his spirit was really remarkable. Then we had what was a very wonderful farewell event. I forget what Sharon, I think, thought of it. Anyway, we talked about it. We had photo sessions with all of the Chinese staff in their groups. The Chinese in the consular section, the Chinese in this section, the other section, making provision for enough copies so that each would get one. And they were all extremely pleased with that. This was the day before we left. Then had the farewell press conference that afternoon, and wound up giving a buffet dinner for all of the embassy family at 6:30 that night, when they presented us with the painting that I had already seen that morning.
How much do you think it cost?
I have no idea.
But that's really quite a gesture.
Yes. Then the next day came the time for departure. We were taking the Pan Am, which was to leave at 11:20 to go to San Francisco. And Mr. Guo, our driver, you remember him, big and burly for a Chinese, always had a stern look on his face. Baggage had gone out ahead, and he was driving Sharon and me out to the airport. He'd always driven like all Chinese drivers, with a lot of verve and dash. On this occasion, he drove very sedately, because he knew that Sharon was a little upset sometimes by his driving. We get out to the airport, and it so happened we were even driving slowly. We were there before anybody else was there. And he says goodbye to us, and tears are rolling down his face. And then all the house staff came out to the airport. Some ambassadors and their spouses came out to see us off, maybe 9 or 10. And some of the women were asking Sharon, what are the Chinese staff out here for? But some of them cried, and all of our staff were out there. It was quite touching. Then we get to San Francisco.
Did the foreign ministry send someone to?
Han Xu was out there, and Chi Chao Ju, not Zhang Wenjin. The staff, I see some of the staff whispering, and one of them called me over and said, we figured out a way for you to get back here. Sharon will rejoin the Foreign Service as a nurse, be dispatched to Peking, and you come out here as her dependent. When we got to San Francisco, we were going to stay in San Francisco for a couple of days. Consul General Hu is out there to see us, because Han Xu had said, well, you're going right through to Washington. I said, no, I'm going to stay in Washington and San Francisco a few days. When are you going to Washington? What flight are you going to Washington on? And I told him. So he had the Consul General come out to the airport to meet us. He apologized because his car was too small to take our baggage. He'd expected to take us to where we were going.
My goodness.
And then we stayed, as I say, in San Francisco a couple of days, then went to